Hi, this is Kale. I want to remind you that this episode has spoilers for Green Hornet by Kevin Smith, with art by Phil Hester and Jonathan Lau. Covers by Alex Ross. You've been warned. Enjoy the show.
And we're back after last week's special episode. Welcome to another regular episode of Matt and Kale Read Comics. Every episode, Kale and I discuss a different graphic novel. My name is Matt Smith. I'm a Canadian and British cartoonist, comics educator living in Paisley, Scotland.
Hi, and I'm Kale Wierke. I'm a longtime mainstream comic book fan, cosplayer, podcaster, YouTuber, collector, and former filmmaker.
The list just keeps growing of Kale's accolades and Kale's job titles. We are excited to talk about Green Hornet, written by Kevin Smith, adapted by Phil Hester, with art by Jonathan Lau. So spoilers for Green Hornet by those three guys. Really quick, Kale, before we introduce our guest, we just got to do a quick correction. I was hanging out with my Glaswegian cartoonist friends this past week, and friend of the show, Jake Haney, pointed out that we misgendered Grant Morrison. Grant Morrison goes by they, them pronouns now, and we were using he, him pronouns when talking about their work. So apologies to Grant Morrison and fans of Grant Morrison. We will hopefully try to do better, use the right pronouns for everyone in the future going forward. But we're talking today about Green Hornet. We are joined by one of my best friends, Kale. This is kind of exciting, you know, that we... This whole podcast, Kale, was started as an excuse for you and I, two best friends, to have an excuse to stay in touch and work on a project together. Our previous episode, 2 weeks ago, we had one of your best friends, Jake, come on the show to talk about Daredevil Yellow. This week, we have one of my best friends, Tyler Eccles, calling in from Korea. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. Really excited to be talking with you. I enjoy any chance to catch up, but also... it's kind of nice that we get to talk comics and you get to be a guest on our podcast. Tyler is a school counselor from Nashville, Tennessee. He's been an international educator for the past 10 years in the Middle East, where he met a very talented and funny cartoonist and educator. His words, not mine. I'm reading his bio. He's also lived in Australia and now in South Korea. He lives there with his wife and three children. He's hoping that his liberal arts education will prepare him to BS his way through this conversation about comics. Thank you for that bio that you sent over, Tyler. You and I met, oh my gosh, man, how long ago was it now?
Oh, man.
8 years?
2012, I believe.
We've been friends for 9 years. We met at orientation. I was wearing a Star Wars shirt, and you came up to me, and you said, oh, hey, I love your t-shirt. And you remember what I said to you?
He said, oh, you've heard of it or something like that.
Like, yeah, I was like, oh, do you know the movie? And I thought it was being really funny, and you were like, what an a-hole.
Yeah, which I, from what it sounds like, is not uncommon when people meet you. So
no, I know. But you know, we still managed to become best friends, and now you're a guest on the show.
Yes, and I believe my wife said something offensive to you in like the first conversation that she said, so like that's how you guys met. So
well, I don't remember that at all, so it mustn't have been that offensive. But yeah, that's our origin story. But you and I were talking before the show and just how you had read comics before, but like I do with many people that I meet, I said, oh, you've read a few comics. Here is a stack of stuff you should read. Do you remember the kind of stuff that I gave you at first?
I think you had suggested like Why the Last Man, and I think you what was the other one that you suggested I really really liked? It was the Powers. I loved Powers.
Yes. Yeah, Powers by Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Avon Oeming. Cops existing in a superhero world and trying to do their best as being street level cops. Why the Last Man, amazing by Brian K. Vaughan and Pia Guerra, who I met in person. She was really nice.
That's super cool.
Yeah. We're talking about Kevin Smith's adapted screenplay. So there's a kind of a cool story behind this book. Anyone who's read the collection. So this was originally a screenplay. Kevin Smith in 2004 was asked by Barf Harvey Weinstein, who is just a terrible human being, but he was head of Miramax at the time. And he asked Kevin Smith, who's a really great guy from all accounts and everything that I've seen from his many, many interviews and Kevin Smith's evening with, and Kale and I have seen him in person. But Kevin Smith was asked to adapt this old radio show, TV show, pulp character, Green Hornet, into a feature-length film. He wrote this screenplay. It never really went anywhere. This is one of those famous properties that they've spent years and years and decades trying to turn into a film. And then eventually they did make it into a film with Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Michelle Gondry. But Kevin Smith's screenplay was just then kind of put aside. And then in 2010, Dynamite Entertainment, Dynamite Comics, asked Kevin Smith if he had any ideas, if he wanted to write Green Hornet comics. He said he didn't really want to come up with anything new. He'd kind of put that aside. And then they asked if they could adapt his unproduced screenplay. And this is kind of the first time I've heard of anything like this. So this comic was produced as 10 issues. So Phil Hester, who Kevin Smith has worked with as an artist, it was his job to take Kevin Smith's script and kind of, he's credited as breakdowns in these issues and this graphic novel. So he took this screenplay and kind of chunked it out into 10 issues. They released it as two collected graphic novels of about 5 issues each, The Sins of the Father and Wearing Oh the Green. And this is 10 issues that represent what would have been Kevin Smith's vision for a feature-length film. So it's got a kind of a cool background. Ty, was this the first time you read this graphic novel?
Yes, it was. I most of the stuff that I'd read before this time was like Sandman and stuff like that. So this is, I think, probably one of the first like big like comic book like volumes that I've read like straight through, and I really liked it.
And do you know much about the Green Hornet character before reading this graphic novel?
I had seen the movie, the Seth Rogen movie. And it was one of those like airplane movies that you watch when you know you're on a 9-hour flight. But
excellent review.
I didn't hate it though. I thought it was, you know, it was exactly what I wanted out of it, which was it was an entertaining, you know, action movie. So
yeah, for sure. I don't know. I mean, we could talk about the film later. It's not really that connected to this. But
well, I actually think it's important to like. I think the first thing that I noticed about the comic book as I was reading is it felt like a movie. Like the pacing of it, and like even the art was like cinematic. So like I don't know, it felt very much like a movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's interesting, and we'll talk about Kevin Smith and his kind of usual, I think we all kind of started, we got a group chat before we started recording, and we used the term Kevin Smithisms. And we'll talk about that, but yeah, it definitely, this graphic novel really feels like a cinematic graphic novel. The art really serves that, but also the epicness and the scale of the story. Kale, when was the first time you read this graphic novel, and what was your familiarity with the Green Hornet character?
Well, I was originally introduced to the Green Hornet in the 66 Batman TV show, which I used to watch when I was a kid, and I currently have the entire series. And so it's kind of nice to watch those episodes because it's obviously a little cheesy. And I think the original series was supposed to be more serious than the Batman show. But, you know, they did a crossover anyway. And that was, I think it was kind of cool. And I knew of the character because also of Bruce Lee. I was a Bruce Lee fan when I was growing up. So I knew of the background of his, you know, the show that he pitched originally, and the character of Kato. So I hadn't read the comic book till we decided to do this episode. So it was kind of nice to read the comic book. But I had also seen the Seth Rogen movie. But I had my own views on that movie at the time. And I still do. I'm just like, it was entertaining, but it was kind of too jokey. At times, and I was just like, well, you know, they should have done it a little bit more seriously, in my opinion.
Yeah, the film, I kind of just made a note, it's thuddingly average. It's just very straight down the middle. It is a little bit jokey, and there's jokes in this graphic novel as well, but it doesn't, it's not forefronted and doesn't overshadow anything else. I think the character's seriousness is still kind of at the heart of all this. You mentioned the TV show. So I knew that there was a 60s TV show. And as a kid, I got really into the Batman 60s TV show. And then I saw like the crossovers. And then I remember I had this memory, this vague memory of being on vacation somewhere, so, you know, an unfamiliar place, and it was late at night, and then the Green Hornet show came on, with not the Batman crossover, just the Green Hornet. And it had that same kind of 60s vibe with, like, tilted Dutch angles and, like, really vibrant, saturated colors. And, but it was, I just remember it being more intense and kind of scary as a young kid, and it took this kind of hyper 60s feel that Batman had, but it was darker and more visceral, and I just remember it being scary. And I was looking up the episode titles. There's titles like Program for Death, The Year of the Corpse, Give Him Enough Rope. I don't know. Tyler, you said you rewatched or watched for the first time some of the episodes before we were recording, and is it as intense as I'm remembering?
It's a little intense. It was one of those things, you know, like I was so excited that I kind of like went off a little bit last night and found a bunch of like Bruce Lee fight scene compilations from Green Hornet. And then also like I watched an episode, they have all the episodes on YouTube. And the first one is about like, it's a silent flashless gun. And so like people keep like getting assassinated in elevators and stuff like that. And they have to find this weapon before, you know, more people die. And it was just like, Britt Reed is very like brooding and it's very intense, which is not at all like the Batman one. Like the Batman in the 60s, of course, is all like,
It's so, the Batman 60s is so jokey and so tongue in cheek. And I think I expected that. And it feels like they set it up like a Batman episode. And then I was like, oh, no, like people are dying. And so it really did stick with me. I haven't gone back and found new episodes, or I haven't rewatched the old episodes. I mean, I did watch the movie just to prepare for this. So before I read this graphic novel, I kind of knew about the character through that. I knew that he was a crime fighter. But I mean, even after doing my research and reading this graphic novel and watching the movie, I still don't quite get the setup of Green Hornet. Can either of you guys explain? So like, he's a vigilante and he's got his sidekick Kato, played famously in the TV show Bruce Lee. This is kind of Bruce Lee's big break and led to Bruce Lee's film career. But he wears a mask and he dresses in his green fedora and his long coat and his suit. And then Kato is supposed to be like his valet, but Kato does all the fighting. Very trained, very skilled martial artist. But the whole setup is that they're pretending to be in the mob. He's pretending to be a criminal so that he can get the criminals under his thumb. But he's also a vigilante. I didn't get it. Can either of you guys explain it, Kale?
Isn't it? It's supposed to have kind of like the you know, the end of the Dark Knight feel, where it's like, you know, he's the villain so that, you know, the heroes can be non superheroes kind of thing. It's got that kind of vibe to it, I think.
Exactly. I think that he's supposed to be kind of a underworld figure that so that he can get probably more information from criminals and stuff like that to bust them or to take over their territory. It's kind of like, remember in Daredevil when he became the Kingpin, that kind of thing. That's what I thought he was trying to do here.
But I need to reread that series, that run of Daredevil by Bendis and Alex Maleev, where he like took over, declared himself Kingpin of Hell's Kitchen. But I don't remember him then. Like, he didn't want people to think that he was, you know, running drugs and running weapons. I don't know. It seems like vigilantism with just more steps. Isn't like being a vigilante enough of being an outlaw? It's very, I don't know, I find it very confusing, but he's a vigilante, he's cleaning up the streets. There's a connection actually to the Lone Ranger. He's actually, the character is canonically the Lone Ranger's grand nephew.
They make an allusion to that in the comic too. They make an allusion to the Lone Ranger in the comic as well.
Is it making fun of the mask?
It's just, you know, it's, you know, the... when he breaks into the club, we're starting in on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Man. We always assume that people have read the graphic novel. So we don't mind jumping around and spoiling things.
Yeah. Cause there, you know, in the scene where he, see, this is the thing, is I think it's so much like a movie. I'm describing each like section as scenes, but when he bashes through the ceiling into that nightclub, the guy is talking about, he's talking about the Green Hornet as if he's the Lone Ranger. Because I remember because he calls him the Long Ranger, and the guy that corrects him, he like makes fun of him for it.
Yeah, so it's weird because so the character was created in 1930. I wrote this down. 1936, he was created as a radio show character. Batman wasn't created until 1939, but this comic, there's references to the Lone Ranger as if the Lone Ranger was a fictional character that people know. And then there's also he flat out references Batman. He says to the old, so the storyline is, this is very much a legacy story. So we've got the Green Hornet and Kato existed in the past, and then they've gone into retirement, and now the Green Hornet's son, Britt Reed Jr., has grown up, but he's kind of a layabout, rich kid, spoiled rich kid, doesn't really do anything with his life. His father is killed, and then the original Kato comes back with his daughter, Mulan Kato, and she's kind of taken up the mantle of Kato, and then through the course of these 10 issues, Britt Reed Jr. takes on the mantle. But at some point, he says to the older Kato something like, if you want to play Batman at your age, go ahead. So he references Batman as if Batman exists as a pop culture figure in this world. But Batman kind of stole a lot of things from Green Hornet. But also, Kevin Smith is a huge Batman fan. So it's there's a lot of Batmanisms that I found as well. But yeah, the TV show only lasted for 1 year, but gave us Bruce Lee, the great Hong Kong action star. And then this film languished for years. They tried to make a movie of it. Do you guys know who was supposed to be cast as Green Hornet in Kevin Smith's adaptation? Kale, did you see that in your research?
I thought it was going to be Ben Affleck. When I was reading the book, I was like, oh, this is totally like Ben Affleck. Even, what's his name? Kevin Smith's sidekick as the mechanic.
Oh, you know, Jay like, Muse.
Jay Muse yeah. as a mechanic. So I was just like picturing all these characters from his movies in this movie. But yeah, who was the original person who was cast or
was, I have to stop you there. Jay Muse was supposed to be Clutch in this movie.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
Cause I wrote that down. I was like, literally in my notes, it says, is the cousin Jay Muse?
Yeah. So Kato, the elder Kato and Mulan Kato, there's another member who's like their mechanic. And he's a Caucasian with long blonde hair. And they make a joke like, oh, we can talk about that joke. But he says, oh, dad liked to eat Chinese food, if you know what I'm saying. So he's of mixed race, apparently. Ugh. But yeah, we'll talk about the depictions of Asian characters in a bit. But I definitely, the first time I read that, I was like, well, of course, like he wrote a part for Jay Muse, who plays Jay to his Silent Bob. That jumped out right away because he looks and acts just like Jay Muse circa 2004. I was trying to play that game, though, Kale, of like, OK, who would have been, you know, because Kevin Smith loves his friends. He just likes hanging out with his friends. He likes casting his friends in his movies. So I was wondering, like, of his friends, who would he have put in as the main role? But he was going to kind of go outside of his repertoire, and Jake Gyllenhaal was supposed to play the part of the main Green Hornet, Britt Reed Jr.
Wow. I guess that makes sense because, I guess, I don't know, Ben Affleck would have been much older, I guess, later on in his, you know, around 2004. So Britt Reed
Which
here
is right
like
after
a,
he did Daredevil.
Oh yeah. But Britt Reed, as here is supposed to, or junior is supposed to be a college student or something, right? So he's in a dorm or something, or at the very beginning of the comic.
Yeah, he's a little bit younger maybe, but yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal, who famously was at one point going to take over as Spider-Man when Tobey Maguire had back injuries, and then finally got to be in a Spider-Man movie recently with Spider-Man Far From Home. Just interesting that he was going to go out kind of outside of his usual gang to cast the main part. So Tyler already mentioned this, that it's great pacing. And I just want to talk about the pacing because it's adapted from a screenplay. And I'm in the middle right now of adapting a short story into a graphic novel. And it's just completely different because the mediums are so different that it's pretty much a page one rewrite. Like there's so little that I've been able to keep. And I kind of, when I first started to adapt this short story, which I did write with the purpose of one day adapting into a graphic novel, I kind of thought it'd be like, you know, maybe a page-to-page translation or even like a scene-to-scene translation, but so much is so different. I've had to start again pretty much from scratch. And I'm just so impressed that they were able to take Kevin Smith's screenplay and make it feel so cinematic, but also it's paced out so well in these issues. I didn't feel like there was any bloat. I didn't feel like they were trying to stretch to make it fit within these very confined 20-something pages per issue. I also thought that each issue ends on such a really natural, great cliffhanger. That's one thing with serialized monthly comics. You want to make sure that the readers are coming back for the next month. And every issue in these 10 issues ends on a cliffhanger that really does make me want to come back. So they did. Phil Hester did such a great job of taking the screenplay and translating it to this other medium. Kale, as a filmmaker, how did you feel about the cinematic qualities of this graphic novel?
I loved it. I mean, of course, you know that I love pretty pictures. So I really enjoyed the cinematic scale of everything and even the art. It's just so beautifully done, and the pacing, as you mentioned earlier, is something that actually helps the overall, like, just the arc of the story. You pay more attention to what's happening, and there aren't too many lulls that I can think of from the story that I could, you know, would be a problem for me, I guess.
No, I think it really moves. Tyler, you said you kind of read it in one go. Like, how many sit downs did you have to do? Because I know you are a father of three, so did you have time to read it all at once?
Well, yeah, I did it. I read volume one and then I read volume two straight through. So, it read like a movie. I think that was the thing that I kept thinking about, because I've read Watchmen all the way through and I really liked Watchmen, and then I saw the movie as well, and I really don't know. I think one of the critiques of Watchmen, the movie, is that it's really slow. But honestly, I kind of feel like the pacing of the comic of Watchmen is also not as rapid, I guess, as like a movie would be. So when I was looking at this and I was looking at it like a movie, it actually felt like the same kind of pacing that the Green Hornet movie had, where it was like, this is meant to be like an exciting action thing that you're going to sit down for an hour and a half and you're done, you know?
First of all, I got to say that I'm very jealous that as a father of three, you were able to read five issues in one sitting, because as a new father myself, my son is just about 3 months old right now. I've had to kind of read this on my phone while I'm, you know, shushing him or in little breaks. So it's been very chunked out, my reading of these 10 issues. So I'm jealous that I have so much to learn from you still, Tyler.
But you got to get on that sleep training, man. That's key. Early.
I do got to say, the kid is a fantastic sleeper. He is sleeping very through important. The night. He gets up once for a quick feed, which Emma takes care of, and then I'm on the morning duty. But he's been sleeping until like 9 o'clock most mornings lately, and nice. It's amazing.
That's where it's at. That's where it's at.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Side note, I'm recording this at 4 a.m. Scotland time in the downstairs cupboard so that I don't wake anyone. Because I thought I'll be really smart here and get up early for my side project so that I can roll into my day job as a father when he gets up around 6. But he hasn't got up. He hasn't been awake around 6 for the last week or so. So I'm just up at 4 a.m. and then I'll have nothing to do for a few hours until he wakes up.
Hey, get that personal time in now when you can, you know. So
I know. I'll start working on whatever we're going to read next. So we all agree this is it's such a cinematic thing. The art definitely helps with that. Art by Jonathan Lau. The pacing and the breakdowns, as they say, by Phil Hester really helps. But also, like, I gotta give props to Kevin Smith. You know, and I'm saying this as a total compliment. It doesn't necessarily feel like a Kevin Smith project. It really doesn't read, you know, Kevin Smith has so many, as we all kind of called them in our group chat, Kevin Smithisms. And I think a lot of his stuff, especially his films, you can kind of pick out, like, from the dialogue, oh, and from the themes and from the characters, oh, this is definitely a Kevin Smith film, a Kevin Smith project. And a lot of his other comics kind of have a lot more of the Kevin Smithisms. But this really felt like he took the project seriously of adapting something that wasn't his and honored it. And it doesn't feel, you know, doesn't have his thumbprints all over it, to his credit. That's really hard to do. Kale, you're a big Kevin Smith fan. Talk about your relationship to Kevin Smith's work and then do you agree that this is kind of outside of his usual stuff?
Yeah, it's out of the usual realm of Kevin Smith films and his, you know, style of kind of silliness, I guess stoner silliness. So it's kind of nice to read his work here. And, you know, I was thinking of his Daredevil run as well and how good that was. And I really enjoy that. That's probably my favorite Kevin Smith comic overall. It's kind of nice to read this comic book and yeah, enjoy it and the pacing of it and everything. And I really feel like he could have directed this film, maybe to give some background on what happened with his script. He turned it down because when they were doing all the merchandising and stuff for the film, he got too nervous with the project because he thought it was too big for him. And honestly, like, I think he could have, if he took this script and directed it, I think it would have been perfect. I think it would have been a way better movie than the Seth Rogen version.
Yeah, I was going to totally say that. I think this would have been way better than the one that actually got made.
I wonder if part of it was budget, because this is a big story and it's kind of cool. And, you know, there are a lot of connections to Batman, but one of the big connections that I saw was literally like the big giant props. And fans of the, especially like the 1960s Batman and, you know, kind of the classic comics, you think of Batman as like these big giant death traps, and he goes to like the warehouse that has, you know, like the giant, I don't know, claw machine. In this story, the Reeds run a newspaper, the Sentinel, and at the top of the Sentinel's building is a giant typewriter, and it's a working typewriter prop. And it's used as a death trap near the climax of the story, where the end of this story, we've got the Green Hornet and Kato. They're strapped down to the keys of this giant working typewriter prop. And Scanlan, the corrupt mayor, he's Scanlan. Pushed into one of the keys, and he's smashed, and it's like splattered and bloodied everywhere. That's not something you would see in one of the Batman stories with these giant props. You never actually see anyone die by these props. But then they use a remote controlled homing missile, and they blow it up, and then they're like thrown through the air, and then they're like flying around, and the Black Beauty turns into a jet at some point, the Stinger, and it's so big. And I wonder if part of it was just, it might have been too expensive, because the Seth Rogen Green Hornet, it feels like the budget wouldn't have supported this screenplay that Kevin Smith wrote. Ty, what's your connection to Kevin Smith and his work?
One of the first movies that I saw, that it was, you know, the movies that like you go over to your friend's house to watch because you're not allowed to watch it, was Mallrats.
And side note, really quick, Ty, just give us some of the TV shows you weren't allowed to watch growing up in your house.
I was a fairly sheltered child, we weren't allowed to watch Full House or Fresh Prince or anything like that. Ironically, we're allowed to watch The Cosby Show, which that decision doesn't age well. But I mean, the show was very wholesome. Just the guy was not.
You started with Full House, because usually you tell me like, oh, he wasn't allowed to watch The Simpsons. I'm like, oh, that's crazy.
That's but true.
That makes sense. And then you say, no, man, we weren't even allowed to watch Full House.
Yeah, we also didn't celebrate Halloween, so it was like a different experience. You know, and. Anyway, all of that to say,
you've made up for that in your adult life, because you and I famously were Batman and Robin for Halloween, and then Captain America and Daredevil.
That time we spent together was the golden age of my Halloween costumes. The you know the, that Captain America costume that we got made. So I tailored. Tailored Captain America costume, and like I made me and France made that Captain America shield out of like a garbage can lid, where I had to buy both the bin and the lid just to get the lid.
That bin ended up at Emma's apartment. sans lid, but she got an extra giant bin for her kitchen.
Yeah, it was great. When we made those costumes for the Dubai Sevens, it was amazing. I'll never forget trying to fit. Yeah, we were living in Kuwait, and we would go to Dubai for the big rugby sevens
tournament
there. It was always really great, but on the way back, I had to figure out how to cram the Captain America shield into my overhead carry-on area, and everybody was very annoyed at me as I was doing that.
Yeah, you took up like half of an entire bin, and we will share photos of Tyler and I in our cosplay as Batman and Robin and Captain America and Daredevil on our social media. But sorry, Tyler, you're talking about going to your friend's house to watch Mallrats.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, Mallrats, the jokes were so, you know, wrong and rude and funny, and I had not laughed that hard in a long time when I first saw it. And it, to this day, you know, jokes about chocolate covered pretzels, you know, like anything like that, it always just makes me laugh. It's just ugh. And the magic eye joke about the schooner is a sailboat, stupid head.
Yeah.
Like that part just always makes me laugh. So that was my first entryway into Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
And then I really enjoyed Dogma, of course, and I saw Clerks, and I honestly, I know this is gonna I'm gonna lose all my nerd street cred here, but like I've never really liked Clerks that much.
I like the story of Clerks better than the actual film. The story that he went to film school, dropped out, and then got his friends together, and they scraped together enough money through credit cards, and he sold his comic book collection and sold his car, and he made a movie, and then he launched an entire career, and now he gets to direct episodes of the DC superhero TV shows like Flash and Supergirl, and he gets to write comics, and he gets to keep making movies with his friends, and it all came from him making this one movie, Clerks, and you know, it's shot on black and white, and not a lot of professional actors are in it, but I've always enjoyed the story of it more than the actual film itself. Kale, you said that your favorite Kevin Smith comics might be Daredevil, but I really like the Clerks comics. I think the Clerks comics are kind of my favorite part of the View Askew universe. That's his kind of connected universe with all of his characters where Jay and Silent Bob show up again. He wrote 3 issues of the Clerks comic books, Continuing Adventures of Dante and Randall and Jay and Silent Bob. And the 3rd issue actually was illustrated by Phil Hester. So that's how they connected for the first time. They went on to work on Green Arrow together and then eventually working on Green Hornet together. So I really liked the Clerks comics. But Ty, like you, my first film of Kevin Smith that I saw was Mallrats. And it was actually on HBO in Malaysia. And Malaysian HBO is heavily censored. So it's not even the TV cut that you would see in the States where they cut out a lot of the swearing, but they cut out even more.
That must have been very confusing.
It was so confusing. It was very choppy. But even through that choppiness, I was like, man, I don't know what it is, but I dig this. And it just seems like everyone's having a good time. And like, I kind of liked living and hanging out in his universe and hanging out with his characters and hanging out with his pals. And it always has his best movies, I think, have this kind of hangout feel that everyone there genuinely likes being around each other. And it's just a good time. And I think you feel that in the best of his films. I do have to say, like, I haven't really connected with some of his later films, but I watched a YouTube video of him talking about Star Wars. And he was saying that a lot of people are coming down on George Lucas for the prequels. And, you know, this rallying crying on the internet that George Lucas ruined my childhood. And Kevin Smith goes, no, man, George Lucas gave me my childhood. You know, it doesn't take away from the original Star Wars trilogy for him that that George Lucas invented this universe that Kevin Smith still loves and lives in. So I know that, you know, his more recent films have a different audience, and I don't connect with some of his recent stuff as much as I did with Mallrats, Chasing Amy, and Dogma. But that's okay, because his later stuff doesn't take away from the connection that I feel still to Dogma. It holds up so well. Emma and I watched it during lockdown, and it's such a strong film still. And those Clerks comics and the comics like this. So, you know, I've been rewatching The Evening with Kevin Smith. I just like listening to that guy talk. I like, you know, hearing his views on life.
And I really think, like, there's very few people who are as genuinely passionate about stuff like he is. Like, the stuff that he's into, he's super into. And I really like listening to him talk about stuff that he's into. There's some, I think it was on one of his, like, talking tours, he did this, I saw this on YouTube, of him talking about the documentary he was supposed to do on Prince.
Oh my gosh, such a great story.
And the punchline to that story is just perfect. Anybody listening, you need to go and watch it. It's incredible.
That was the first Evening with Kevin Smith.
Oh, it's so good.
Some great stories on that one. Kale and I have actually seen him do the Evening with Kevin Smith live. Kale, a couple years ago, I was living in Victoria, but I happened to be over in Vancouver for the weekend, the same weekend as Fan Expo, and you got us tickets to go see Kevin Smith, and I thought that was really great. My favorite part, Kale, I don't know if you remember this, but someone stands up to ask a question, and he says something, and that kind of kicks Kevin Smith off, and he starts talking, and he gives like a 20-minute story, as he does, and then he ends by saying, "Does that answer your question?" Do you remember what the whole audience yelled out, Kale?
I don't quite remember.
Everyone yelled out, "He didn't ask his question." And it just... so amazing that Kevin Smith, I mean, he's always got a story. He's always, you know, got something to say, but he didn't even let the guy finish his question before he went off and told this, you know, amazing 20-minute story that had the whole audience, you know, with rapt attention. And then he gets to his end. He goes, "Anyway, does that answer your question?" And realized the guy hadn't even got to his question yet. So then the guy asked his question and he continued. But that was a cool experience seeing Kevin Smith live, Kale. That was a cool thing that you got for us.
Yeah, no worries. And I've seen him live two more times after that, actually. I saw him at Hollywood Babylon with you again, and then another time by myself here. So I have enjoyed his stuff. I think the first movie of his that I saw actually was Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And then I saw Dogma, whichever one came first. I'm not sure which one. But then I was like, oh, I'm totally into this guy. But then some of his movies afterwards, I saw Clerks 2, and I still enjoyed it, but not to the same level as those other movies. But yeah, I've been reading his comics, you know, since the 90s. I'm a kid of the 90s. So like his, you know, Green Arrow run, as you mentioned, Daredevil. And, you know, I like his way of telling stories. Again, as you mentioned, the hanging out part of his characters, you know, it feels like you're hanging out with your friends, and that's kind of cool, you know, just to be around those characters. But yeah, his stuff is always like dialogue heavy, and, you know, coming back to this comic book, yeah, he has dialogue in it, but sometimes it's not as dialogue heavy as you would think a Kevin Smith script would be. So it's kind of cool. It's something completely different.
Yeah, to his credit, if you read any of the supplemental material in Guardian Devil, he teamed up with Joe Quesada, and Joe Quesada says that Kevin Smith was giving him scripts that read like his Kevin Smith films, just like full of dialogue and full of monologues. And he was just, I think, basically said, you know, "You're not leaving me any room to draw any pictures, man." And it's just, again, to his credit, you know, this isn't a comic where it's just, you know, little character heads being squashed by massive speech balloons. I think there's very little monologuing there. It's reads very much like, you know, I don't want to say this is to be condescending, but like a grown-up movie script. Like, it doesn't feel like, you know, he's just gonna talk about whatever he wants and have Green Hornet and Kato hanging out in the Black Beauty and talking about girls and talking about, you know, smoking weed like in his movies. He's very much, you know, rising to the occasion, and he's fulfilling the assignment. Like, he's doing the project, he's doing what's expected. I really think, you know, this is a great introduction to this character. It really toes the line between being this legacy story. So it's, you know, the children of the original Green Hornet and Kato, but it really does, I think, kind of catch you up and introduce you to this world. And I think it's a really great reboot, and it's really great, and I think, for just new readers who might not know about this character, about this world, I think he does a really good job of bringing people in.
Absolutely. I agree with that. He has a really good, like, character arc, even for Britt Reed Jr., and like even the overall just story, I think, is really good. And it's so big budget, as you said earlier. You know, I was thinking of the climax and the Black Beauty and like the jet, and, you know, the huge typewriter and the explosions, and it was a huge action movie, and I've never seen a script of his that was kind of like that. I was also thinking that, you know, at this time, I think he was doing, or maybe a little bit earlier, he was working on the Superman script as well. And I was kind of curious to see what he wrote for that. You know, he's spoken about the story several times, but, you know, again, it would have been a stretch from his normal material.
Yeah, on that same DVD, The Evening with Kevin Smith, that Tyler mentioned, he also talks about working on Superman Lives. And that's an amazing story as well. That the Prince and the Superman Lives stories are fantastic. So seek those out, because Kevin Smith is a really great storyteller and he tells a great yarn with both of those. But they both, the Superman Lives kind of went away as well. But yeah, he, a few times, you know, studios would, you know, they could tell that he was into comic books and tried to come and bring him in and write a comic book movie for them. But, you know, he nails it. Do you guys want to go through just kind of the things we liked? And then there are a few things with the writing that I think we all kind of want to address that might be a little bit problematic, maybe haven't aged so well. This was a script originally written in 2004. This comic came out 11 years ago. But things that you really enjoyed from the writing, Tyler, anything you want to highlight?
So I love that it feels like a movie. And I think one of my favorite gags in the story is the uniform gag where he like, yes, or the costume gag where he's like, you know, he's like, oh, I want this costume to look like this. And then like the night vision goggles don't work. And then like, he's like, no, give me something else. And the progression of that has, you know, I think I could see that as a movie, and I really, really liked that. I also really loved the ejection seat that turns into the jet, right, at the end of when they run the Black Beauty into the, or they, you know, save the orphanage, which is also hilarious.
So good. Just such great stakes. They're yeah. Running towards an orphanage at the end of the road. They have to eject or blow up the Black Beauty.
Right, and I have written down Deus Ex Ejection Seatica for that. Like I love that. He's like, oh, you didn't know I put that one in the thing. And it felt very much like the end of Dark Knight Rises as well. Spoiler alert, everybody. Sorry. You know, it's like, oh, that was fixed. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you about the ejector seat.
Exactly. So that kind of stuff. And then I think the number one thing that I kept coming back to as I was reading through the comic was the art was amazing. Like it not only like the pacing felt like a movie and there was the dialogue and the action and stuff like that, but the panels that had all the action and the explosions and the fighting and stuff like that, everything just was perfectly done. And like it felt like it was a movie. Like I know I keep saying that over and over again, but like the action was so great.
Yeah, props to Jonathan Lau. Really, yes, well illustrated. Kale, you always talk about how you like pretty pictures, and one thing that I kind of noticed about the art, you know, I know we're jumping to the art really quick, we'll jump back to the writing, but the layouts, for the most part, there's a few times where he's got some interesting page layouts with kind of floating panels above a larger background splash page. But for the most part, it's very clean, very straightforward page layouts. You know, it's kind of on a grid. It's, you know, just kind of rectangles, and it doesn't challenge you with the reading order like some of the, you know, in your face crazy layouts. It is very straightforward, and it just really, I feel, kind of lets the story speak for itself and does make it feel a bit more cinematic. Did you notice that, Kale, this kind of very, you know, no-nonsense page layout approach?
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of reminded me of the comics that I used to read when I was a kid.
Yeah, not so much this kind of 90s craziness. Like, it was just good, solid, fundamental comicking. Kale, anything from the writing that you kind of want to praise, or any notes that you made of just kind of stuff that you really enjoyed?
I actually like the dialogue from Britt as a quote-unquote, like, modern, like, young man, I guess, getting into the new game. And it's just, like, as a writer, I mean, I've written several scripts as well. So I know, like, maybe there's a bit of the voice of Kevin Smith in the character as well. But I felt like it kind of differentiated him from the rest of the cast a little bit. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, really strong characters, I thought. You know, we've got the older Kato, who's very no-nonsense. The younger Mulan Kato, also no-nonsense. Really kick-ass. She does a lot of cool fighting. You know, she's wearing high heels during a fight scene, which is a bit of, you know, of a cliche of action films, but she uses them tactically. Like, she jumps up and slams her heel into the ceiling, and then she is suspended from the ceiling and then continues fighting from this kind of suspended vantage point. I don't understand the part where she uses her dress like a whip. I don't know if you guys picked up on that when she, like, these, you know, the henchmen show up and she whips her dress and a tendril from her dress whips around a katana. And then she's like swinging her dress around and that's how she sword fights. I don't quite understand the physics there.
It's very crouching tiger, hidden dragon kind of with the robes. Yeah,
so maybe there was a studio note to include something like that, because I think that was Miramax as well, or at least they might have distributed that. So maybe that was a studio mandated inclusion. But
maybe
I dig these characters. Some things that I just thought was kind of funny. There's at one point where Kato says, "Press the green button" in the Black Beauty, and Green Hornet Britt Jr. says, "They're all green." And I just like this idea that they're so committed to the green, you know, theme that all the buttons inside their car are green and it's impossible to tell them apart.
I was just going to say, like, one of the things I really like too is, you know, I've always loved onomatopoeia from comics, and the addition of a yoink was one of my favorite things that they put in, and so I really enjoyed that.
Where did the yoink come in?
It was in one of the fight scenes. I think Mulan grabs, she's able to like take something out of the big bad's hands, and like it literally says yoink, and it made me laugh.
There's great sound effects. I really like when comics embrace sound effects. It's such a great convention that I think a lot of comics, modern comics, kind of shy away from. I think, again, there is this kind of cartoony comic booky association with them. But there's great sound effects, and it really does place you in the fight scenes when they're shooting people with little hornet darts and there's guns blasting and people are yoinking things away and, you know, punches. Great, great sound effects, all of course in green. Really, really great sound effects. I really liked the thing where the Black Hornet, the villain, is trying to pick someone from the crowd, I think, to kill, and he's going eeny meeny miny, and Britt Reed Jr.'s there, but he's dressed in a tuxedo and he can't reveal his secret identity. And then just as the Black Hornet gets to eeny meeny miny, Mulan slides a briefcase with his Green Hornet costume and he goes, "Whoa." So I really like that pacing of eeny, meeny, miny, whoa. And then he jumps into action as the Green Hornet. Great costume, great costume. I really like that run, that montage of trying different costumes and ending up with kind of the more traditional Green Hornet costume of the fedora, the mask, and the suit. Such a cool costume.
What did you think of the like cape on the suit itself? That's something that I've never seen before. I think it was originally designed by Alex Ross for this book.
Yes.
So
I liked it, man. I think it gives him a cool silhouette. I think, you know, having open flowing material is really great visually in comics. Ty, what do you think of the main costume that he ends up kind of wearing for most of the story?
I liked that. I thought it was when they first started the uniform gags, I was like, "Oh, this is a little too Splinter Cell for me." But the way that it has kind of like the simultaneously the same aesthetic with the fedora and the cape, so it gives you kind of like the allusion to the trench coat, but also has kind of the almost Superman-ish, you know, mm-hmm. skin tight muscular, you know, arm parts. So I thought were pretty cool.
Yeah. Kale, did you like it?
I was maybe a little bit bothered by it because I liked the trench coat itself in the original TV show. So I was like, "Oh, why do you need a cape over a trench coat?" I just couldn't quite get the logic of that. But, you know, hey, if it works, it works. I mean, it's still visually interesting. I think I was more bothered by the practicality of it than anything else.
Yeah. I could see that. I mean, you know, if you really think about it, fighting crime in a cape is just leaving yourself open. I do like in Batman comics that he kind of justifies it as, you know, a swirling cape. You never really know where his body is. If you have a gun, you never really know where to take aim, and he can use it to distract people. But in practicality, you know, having a cape is not the best way probably to be a vigilante. One last thing about the costumes that I want to say. When Mulan Kato is training, she's in a yellow jumpsuit. Very much a reference to Bruce Lee's costume in Game of Death. And it's also similar to the one the Bride wore in Kill Bill when she's referencing Bruce Lee. And when she goes to Japan, and when she first arrives in Japan, do you guys remember what song they use?
It's the 60s theme song. The 60s Green Hornet.
60s theme song, yeah.
Yeah.
What, amazing theme song. Amazing theme song. The
I had no idea. I think I texted you last night to tell you as I got deeper into my Green Hornet wormhole, YouTube wormhole. But yeah, I looked at the scene from Kill Bill and was like, oh, I totally just thought it was like a Dick Dale like thing, which, you know, obviously Tarantino loving that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, references on references on references. It all, you know, alludes back to each other. But I thought that was kind of cool that they're paying homage to Bruce Lee in this comic. The the one thing in the writing that I thought was kind of funny early on, Britt Reed Jr. is talking to his father, the original Green Hornet. And he gives him this throwaway line. It's like, number one, tells us like what a waste of skills he has, but also sets us up to kind of make it more plausible that he can become a vigilante. And he says, you know, you're a valedictorian and a 6-time kickboxing champion. And he just kind of drops that there just to make it just a little less ridiculous when this, you know, layabout playboy becomes a vigilante later. Did you guys pick up on that note of like, you know, you were a kickboxing champion and now look at what you're doing?
I love stuff like that. It's the same thing where it's like, oh, you're ex-military, you know, like in like any action movie ever. It's like a mailman and he's like, yeah, but I was a Delta Force, you know.
I know. It's that's exactly what I thought of. It's the action movie cliche of like, well, before I was, you know, just a father of two and, you know, yeah, a mailman, I did, you know, Navy SEALs, special ops, so I can, you know, break out the kung fu anytime I need to. There are a few things that, as I said, maybe don't age as well. Kale, are there any things that you want to kind of address, you know, now that we have talked about how much we do enjoy this comic? There are a few things.
Yeah, I mentioned some in our chat earlier. There were things like the... when he says, like, you know, this is tits, or he said to, I think it was Kato, he says, like, you like chicks? And, you know, that kind of, like, I guess just immature kind of language. Also, of course, you could think of the, just the whole treatment of Asian characters. In just even the wider mythology of the Green Hornet, you know, and Kato obviously being the more skilled fighter, and actually, you know, he's not the sidekick, he should be the main character. But in this, of course, in this comic also, Kato, you know, the female Kato is more of a sidekick as well. And you mentioned the line by Clutch. There are things like that just everywhere in this comic, I would say.
Yeah, let's take it one at a time.
Sure. So, there are a lot.
the Kato's being the sidekicks, but really they're much more accomplished and they're much more capable. I do like that trope in general. Like, I'm even thinking about Inspector Gadget. Like, he's completely hopeless, but Penny, his daughter, is really, you know, the one who solves all the crimes. You know,
it's a deep pull, man.
Yeah, I know. but it is like a common trope that, you know, the sidekick is really the one who's getting everything done. And then I do like this idea, you know, he's a much more vulnerable hero than Batman. You know, Batman is very infallible, and, you know, Batman always has a million plans, and he's such a great tactician, and he's never caught off guard, very rarely. This Green Hornet, like, he's a buffoon. Both the younger and the newer Green Hornet would be nothing without their Kato's, and I like that. But Kale, do you think it kind of borders on mystical Asian stereotypes that this Asian sidekick or partner is just so supernaturally skilled?
Absolutely. And you could even think of the Asian stereotype of the senior Kato being the wise master that teaches this white man how to, you know, fight crime. there's that as well. And I think they, you know, I was thinking of the movie Doctor Strange, and in that they replaced the Ancient One with a Celtic witch. So just to kind of avoid that trope of the Ancient One being this wise Asian man, or, you know, it's sometimes even a wise Black man or something, you know, there's some kind of like, I guess, I don't want to say tribal knowledge, even that statement, that those words are also kind of dated now, obviously, but yeah, someone with kind of like this mystic kind of knowledge from the Orient or some other culture coming in and teaching a man who doesn't know any of that to either fight or become better at, you know, whatever they're trying to achieve.
But then also building up the white guy to then take the you know, to step into the spotlight and take the, you know, the acclaim.
So there was, I always had a problem with that with the Green Hornet, because I mean, imagine like Bruce Lee coming in, right? Like there, I have seen the videos of Bruce Lee showing his martial arts skills, and you know, this guy who's a great actor, good looking, has really great martial arts skills, and he's not given the lead role because they needed a white guy to be the main character. I don't know, I think that's something that's wrong with Hollywood. It's improving, but still it's happening pretty often. Most recently with Iron Fist, where they cast somebody who's not a martial artist and not Asian as Danny Rand. And Danny Rand, of course, traditionally in the comics is white, again, because he was based off from, you know, the 60s and 70s. So like there was, they almost cast a guy who was half Asian as Danny Rand, and they still didn't do it. So, I mean, it's still happening in Hollywood.
But this, as we've been talking about, like this is adapted from a property from the mid 1930s. And, you know, if you're going to adapt this, how can you get away from that kind of stereotype? I mean, I think Kevin Smith does his darndest by just making both Green Hornets be such buffoons that they need their Katos to always come to their aid and to actually solve all their problems. But I mean, is this relationship, is this dynamic salvageable, do you think, Kale?
Yeah, instead of a sidekick, I think it would have been great to have it be a partner. I know it's more of a partner, I guess, with the younger Kato, but maybe even, you know, like I was thinking that like Kato could, you know, take the lead a little bit more. And, you know, it's not so much a fish out of water kind of situation for Britt. But I guess that also makes the character a little bit more or less interesting overall, right? It's all about the perspective of someone who is, you know, the outside perspective, you know, to bring the audience in, right? So the outsider perspective actually helps in storytelling. But, you know, I would think that it would have been, yeah, just better for Kato to just, I don't know, be more actualized, I guess, overall in the story.
I will say that in this kind of legacy universe that Kevin Smith kicks off, eventually this Mulan Kato becomes Green Hornet herself. So she does at some point assume the mantle in one of the spin-offs or the sequel series to this. But the character of Kato himself, the original Kato, is really kind of confusing because they keep switching his nationality. And he starts out, I believe, as Japanese. And then when Japan invaded China in the 40s during World War II, they decided that was problematic and maybe a little bit offensive. And so he became his background kind of morphed into being more Chinese. At a certain point, he was Filipino. It's even in this, it's kind of unclear. And the series continues after Kevin Smith leaves the project because he only, you know, wrote this screenplay. And then they continued this as a regular ongoing series. And Phil Hester took on the main writing duties. and the Katos are able to speak Mandarin and Japanese fluently. So I think they have mixed heritage, but it is unclear. I mean, Tyler, in your watchings of the original series, did they definitively say what nationality Kato is?
I don't think so. There's, you know, obviously one of the problematic tropes from, you know, like late, you know, mid 20th century television and movies and film and stuff is this kind of like mixed heritage, like you're Asian, you're, you know, African, you're, you know, like, and so watching the show, it was like he wore kind of like Chinese style clothes and things like that. But there was a lot of other, like, there is like Japanese and even like Korean, like symbolism and like imagery in like the different groups that they interact with. So it's not, you know, I think it's always kind of ambiguously Asian, which I think is, you know, obviously kind of problematic.
Yeah, I mean, and that would help, I think, with Kale's note about making him a bit more self-actualized if he was a bit more defined, even just down to the basics of what country is he from. Even if he is, like, mixed heritage of multiple nationalities from Asia, but just to get specific, I think, would help just kind of round him out as a character. But the other thing that we mentioned, Kale, is the handling of Mulan Kato's sexuality. And I think it was kind of cool. I'm on board for this this second generation having a female Kato, and she does kick ass. She's a really strong, powerful woman, very capable, very skilled fighter. And I thought it was interesting, you know, this partnership where now we got a female-male partnership when the original Green Hornet and Kato was male-male. And it made me think of, I'm a big fan of Alfred Hitchcock, and he adapted a story, The 39 Steps. I believe it was a novel. And in the novel, these two guys are handcuffed, and then they go on the run, and there's a big spy plot, and it's just mostly them on the run together, but they're constantly shackled to each other. When Hitchcock made the film, he turned one of the characters into a female, because he said, suddenly now you've got this sort of sexual tension, and now you've got this kind of B plot of will they, won't they, and will these two characters end up together? And just creates this other tension that wasn't there in the original script. So I like the idea that it seems like Kevin Smith is doing something similar. Number one, you know, he's got a little bit more diversity with the prominent female character. But number two, there is this sort of tension, and Britt obviously is attracted to Mulan Kato. And there's these kind of hints that they might hook up, they might get together. But then I really like that she shoots him down at the end of the story and, you know, lets him know that she's actually prefers women and she's into girls. And I thought that was kind of a cool inversion, because again, on the Kevin Smith's Evening With, where he's just talking and answering questions, he talks about how his brother is gay, and his brother always told him that he can't connect to a lot of mainstream media because he doesn't see himself represented in heterosexual, heteronormative relationships. So he says that anytime he makes a movie, he throws in some LGBTQA content for his brother and for, you know, his brother's friends. And I like that he was bringing that to this very mainstream, very old property. What did you guys think of the way they handled that? Because the very last page, Britt is just, his mind is blown and just can't comprehend. And his last piece of dialogue is like, seriously, chicks? And she just says, shut up and punch somebody. But, you know, that's how the story ends, with him just like, what? A girl who likes girls? Tyler, how did you feel about this whole reveal and how they handled it?
I mean, so as a school counselor and noted human, I am very happy to see, you know, expanded representation of people, especially members of the LGBTQ+ community. Very, very excited to see that. Although, like, you know, I think, you know, I don't know. What kind of conversations did Kevin Smith have with you know, members of that community to create that character? I don't know, right? And there's always going to be a shade of like, you're a cis straight white guy trying to inject this thing in here, and it feels a little shoehorned in. And it wasn't part of her character, which, you know, it doesn't have to be, but it, you know, it makes it, you know, kind of like a, just like a, like it's shoehorned in, I think is the way I would say it. And I don't know how impactful that is. I'm glad that he did it, but it still feels a little like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I need to add a gay character in here. So I'm going to do that. So I don't know. It felt a little bit like an afterthought, and it felt a little bit performative, I guess. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, for my students who are in that situation and kind of like seeking out different examples of that in pop culture, you know, to have it at all is wonderful for them to find it. But it is, you know, it is also we want to make sure that it's also like, you know, valuable and expansive, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. I think so. I'm not sure.
Would you have preferred if it was introduced earlier?
I think so. You know, like, I think, you know, it doesn't have to be the main thing about the character. You know, that character doesn't need to be the token, you know, token gay character. It doesn't have to be the, you know, token whatever character. But to have that be something that we know about Mulan immediately, like, kind of says, like, this is a gay character in this comic book. And so, like, that's something that's part of her identity, instead of thinking this whole time the will they won't they, and like, oh, and you know, like, and that was the other thing I was gonna say, like, the like, you know, it is comics, so like, it is what it is, but like, the hypersexualization of her body in that outfit is like, you have that whole thing this whole time, and then at the end is like, well, actually I'm into girls, you know. And it's just, it feels a, I don't know, I think it would have, you know, given her a more rounded out character. Yeah, and I liked the character of Mulan as well. Like, I thought she was wonderful. But I think to make the point about her sexual identity, I think would have been more effective at the beginning as opposed to the end, and kind of this afterthought.
Yeah, it literally comes in like the last two pages, maybe. But it also is just,
it felt like a joke, right? It felt like a punchline. It didn't feel it didn't feel like you were making it a part of this character's personality.
Yeah. You're so right by saying it's a punchline. It does feel like it's less about inclusion and more about toying with audience expectations. You've got a male and female protagonists. They're, you know, they're in these situations together. There's like, they're in skin tight, form fitting costumes. You know, they're working up a sweat. They're like, you know, they're, you know, fighting. They're going out and kicking ass together. And then, you know, you would expect maybe they would get together, but then no, actually I'm into girls. And that kind of deflates the sexual tension. But you're right. It is played more as a subversion of that trope more than including her as an LGBTQ+ character. Kale, how did you feel about this whole situation?
Yeah, it did definitely feel shoehorned in. But I also thought later on in the series, Kato and Britt actually get together in some fashion. So like, they kind of undo everything anyway. So it just,
they walk it back so smooth.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So I said Phil Hester takes over as the main writer and continues with Jonathan Lau for a few issues, and then they eventually both move on to other projects. But it's like only a couple issues later, they're having a quiet moment, and Britt says to Kato, listen, about what you said a few weeks ago back in the nest about, you know, liking girls. Is that like a hard and fast rule or more of a guideline? And Kato says, Britt, for such a well-known smartass, you have a hard time telling when someone is screwing with you. And so...
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So it gets worse. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And it,
well, I like, mean, and there's an opportunity to, like, have a bisexual character, you know? Yes. Like, which, like, again, is something that, like, there's very little examples of that in pop culture. You know, like, the fact that, like, they had, I think it was, I think it's in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, right? Like Rosa is bisexual. And, like, that is a great development of that character. And it brings in a whole nother demographic group into this, you know, the audience of this TV show and the characters in the TV show. So, I don't know, man. I was like, that's so disappointing.
It feels like, I wonder if it made it to the screen, if they would have included that part in the actual movie, if that would have been something that the studio would have said, whoa, you know, take away this line about her liking chicks. You know, we want to play up the sexual tension and maybe, you know, let people think that if we make a sequel, because this is obviously meant to launch a franchise that feels very much like that, that they will maybe hook up down the line. But Kevin Smith maybe was like, no, man, I want to have this inclusion. I want to include this. And then they're like, okay, fine. Like, you know, we're never going to make this movie, so write whatever you want. And then when they turned it into an actual script, maybe Dynamite then decided, whoa, let's walk it back a little bit. I don't know. I don't know where the decision was made to walk it back. Maybe they saw more storytelling opportunities in the two of them becoming a couple, as well as partners, you know, crime fighting partners and romantic partners. I agree that would be more interesting, but it is just kind of a bummer that they set it up with one writer and then the next writer kind of undoes that and kind of rewinds that. And I've talked about this before on the podcast. Like, there's a reason why I kind of follow creators and mostly writers, because when a new writing team comes on or a new writer takes over, even if the art is the same, because Jonathan Lau stayed on the project, there's a definite shift when it becomes Kevin Smith scripts and they turn into Phil Hester scripts without Kevin Smith. And that's one of the main things. It's just a hard line in the sand, the question of Kato's sexuality. We should talk about the art, Jonathan Lau's art. We've all praised it. There's one interesting thing about the art, and I don't know if you guys got this sort of kind of sketchy feel to it, and if you notice this in the credits for all the books, it doesn't say art by Jonathan Lau, and it doesn't say pencils by Jonathan Lau and inks by someone else. Usually mainstream comics, you would have someone who does the pencils, the, you know, literally draws everything in pencils, and then someone else would ink it and draw it in ink, and that's where you get like the kind of crisp, finished final art. Then that's the art that we see that then is colored. But the credits for these books just say pencils by Jonathan Lau. And I did some research, and bleedingcool.com, he talks about his process, and he doesn't do ink. So he only does pencils. He does rough thumbnails, like really messy kind of sketches. Then he does just pencils for the art and then scans that and then plays around with the contrast. And then that's what is colored by the colorist. So there's never any inks. This is all just pencils. Did you guys notice that? Did you get that sort of pencil-y feel? Ty, did you notice anything about the art?
It did. I think I honestly don't know if I know enough about the way that inking and stuff like that works, other than the, you know, conversations that we've had about it. I think the way that everything kind of, I don't know, it felt more like dynamic and I guess softer. Does that make more sense? Like it felt like it was. And I think that gave into the illusion of kind of like the moving scene, the movie aspect of it with like all the action and everything. I think that was really cool.
Kale, what do you think of this sort of, I kind of wrote down, it feels very wispy sometimes, you know, and this kind of fluidity of movement, because it is just not as, you know, exact, I guess is the word I'm looking for. You know, the inking stage is kind of, at least for me, and I think looking at a lot of production of comics, the pencils, you're kind of finding your line, and maybe you do the same kind of line a few times and you find, no, this is the exact stroke that I want. And then the inking, you do it once and that's, you're deciding this is, you know, the way that the line goes. How did you feel about Jonathan Lau's pencils, Kale?
Yeah, his pencils are amazing. I thought that like the inking even, it's like, I don't know, I would say digital, like it didn't seem like it was popping out at me as much. I thought it was like very smooth, and maybe that's the look that they were going with, trying to make it look kind of cinematic, where like an adaptation versus a traditional comic. So I really enjoyed it. We should also talk about Alex Ross's art and his covers, because those are also very cinematic and realistic looking, like, you know, his paintings. And so it's just, I think it just helps the overall look of the book.
Yeah, so each issue has a fully painted Alex Ross cover. Alex Ross mostly does comic book covers now. He has done comic book issues and graphic novels, but it just takes him forever to draw because everyone looks so photorealistic and he does so much photo reference. And, you know, his Batman, it looks like he's actually wearing like a tangible costume that someone has made. His Superman looks like he's actually wearing a costume made out of material, and you can see every wrinkle, every crevice of Superman's face, and everything looks so photorealistic. All these covers were done by Alex Ross. They also, as Dynamite always does, they also have alternative covers, and I really like that these collections included the alternative covers, because I love the John Cassidy covers. He's one of my favorite artists as well. Another artist who is doing more and more cover art and less interior stuff. Tyler, what do you think of Alex Ross's covers? Those photorealistic, fully painted covers.
The first time I ever saw anything Alex Ross did, it was the Justice League paintings that I think they were. I'm not sure if they were covers for Justice League or not, but they're just
long, like, yeah, like 30, 40 characters all posing dramatically, yes, lit, looking at you. Yeah, he's done Justice League, the Future Justice League. He's done the Villain Society or whatever they're called. Yeah.
And they're breathtaking. Like, they're genuinely beautiful to look at. Even if you don't like comics or superheroes or whatever, they're just beautiful paintings, right? Or you know, art. And so to see what he did here, it was, they're just so epic. They're so, you know, I don't know how you're able to get that much detail and emotion and motion into every nook and cranny of these paintings. They're just amazing.
Deep folds, dark shadows, like the clothing looks tangible. Yeah.
Yeah. And like there's, you know, like, there's just stuff in every corner too. like you have, it fills up the whole page. It's not just like, oh, here's the center thing and that's all you look at. It's like looking at the whole thing is just, there's something everywhere. It's wonderful.
He's immensely talented. When I do my comics making lessons, and I started making my comics or started doing my comics making lessons when Tyler and I talked together in Kuwait. That's how we met. We were teaching at an international school in Kuwait. And much like this podcast, I kind of use that job very often as an excuse to just go hang out with my friends and go co-teach with Tyler and our other friends. And it was an amazing job. And I got to hang out with really great educators and learn from them and just do fun projects. But we would do comics in Tyler's class, and I would show examples of Alex Ross's art, and I would just point out like just how long it takes him to make a page. And then I would show him, you know, like Mike Allred's art, which is a lot more flat and poppy and pop arty, and just point out, you know, they're both communicating and one takes probably a lot less time. So maybe if you're making comics, think about where you want to put your time and effort. And that's what I said, like Alex Ross doesn't produce that many comic pages anymore because it just takes forever to do something that realistic. And also, I struggle with reading Alex Ross's comics that he illustrates because there's just so much detail that it does, I feel, it kind of interrupts the page flow. It interrupts my reading because my eye is working that much harder to process and take in all those little bits of information in every corner, like Tyler said. Kale, how do you feel about reading an Alex Ross page when it is, you know, 6 to 9 panels of this hyper detailed photorealistic painting?
It takes me a while. I like to look at all the minor details in each painting. I was just thinking of Kingdom Come, and when I read that, and how long it took me to read that, just because I was like, who's that character? Who's that character? You know, like, it was, there's so much going on, and it's not a bad thing. It's beautiful. I can't imagine how long it would have taken him to, you know, do a full comic with that kind of art. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and another thing I just want to say is with comic covers, and I talked about this on my creator commentary for any listeners, last episode was a bonus episode where I talked about the thought process and the creation of the first chapter of my graphic novel, You're Stuck With Me Now, a comic which features Kale and Tyler as a character. Tyler is kind of the main character, the Matt character's sidekick for most of the book, but they both appear in the book. And Tyler, I just want to say again, thank you so much. I give you a thank you at the end of the book for just always giving me feedback at every draft and every stage of that book. But I talk about in this commentary that I really don't I get upset, and I'm kind of used to it now, but I would get upset as a kid getting a comic book with a really crazy awesome cover, like an Alex Ross cover, and then the interior art doesn't match that, and they have a different artist doing the interior art, and I always kind of found it as like a bit of a bait and switch. And I know now, you know, you very much sell a comic book, especially individual issues, because they're facing out on the strength of the cover, so I understand why they do it, but it does bug me when it doesn't line up exactly. And the one thing that I really want to talk about with this series is issue 6. The cover is the Green Hornet and Kato making out on the hood of the Black Beauty, the car. Did you guys clock that issue where it's, I don't know whose decision that was. Like, they definitely don't kiss in that issue. They definitely don't kiss for the rest of the book, but they are very literally depicting the sexual tension with them making out on top of the Black Beauty. What'd you think of that, Ty?
I rolled my eyes a little bit. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, and by the way, thank you so much for the shout out. I also listened to your commentary episode. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
That to say, it felt a little like, what are you guys doing? Come on, man. Like I think one of the things that I have come to expect from a Kevin Smith vehicle is he's not going to do, there's going to be some kind of twist, or there's going to be some kind of, like, you know, it's not going to be the normal, you know, expectation. So, you know, when you do the male female superhero kind of thing, it's like, obviously they're going to, you know, you hook up at the end. But like, and so like, as soon as we started off with like a female Kato and a male Green Hornet, I was like, okay, they won't. And so when I saw the kissing cover, I was like, all right, what are you guys doing here? Are you just selling comic books? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, it was just such an odd decision to make. Kale, who do you think they told Alex Ross, like, hey, we're playing up the sexual tension? Because I know that with covers, they have to produce the covers sometimes months in advance of the issues actually coming out. Do you think there was a miscommunication, or do you think that they asked him to depict this scene?
I think he possibly did it as on his own, or maybe it is something that they asked. I'm not sure, but my feeling is that he kind of misunderstood the whole relationship between Kato and Britt, and that's what he created. So maybe he didn't read the script, and he was just like, oh, there's a female Kato. Obviously, they're going to hook up or something. And so, yeah, he just created a cover based on that.
It does feel a little like the old classic superhero comics of like, not an imaginary story, not a dream. Kato and Green Hornet finally together, read inside. And then it's like, no, it was just like a fantasy of the Green Hornets. I don't know. It just really is such a crazy example of the covers, the interiors not delivering what the cover promises. I just thought it was kind of mind-boggling. We're going to wrap up. Before we do, any last notes you want to say about this book, Tyler, or anything else about the eventual film that they did make in 2011?
I think all in all, I really, really enjoyed it. I think the only thing that I didn't touch on was the surprising and gruesome death of Mayor Scanlon. I was like, you know, obviously there's a lot of like fighting and kicking and, you know, violent gun deaths in this book. But that was gruesome. I was not expecting that. and so that one caught me by surprise. I think it's meant to be a like turning point in the, you know, in the book, but it is definitely like, there was definitely a moment where I was like, that was a lot for this thing right now.
Definitely, he ramps up the stakes as he gets to the last. I think like the climax really takes place over like 2.5 issues. Like it's great bang for your buck that the last couple of issues were so jam packed with action. But yeah, Scanlon, his death, it's really, yeah, he's not messing around with that giant typewriter.
But all in all, I was really, you know, You've never steered me wrong with a comic before, and I really enjoy this, and I just was so surprised at how cinematic and how much like a movie it felt. And when I finished it up, I was like, that was really good. All right. You know, like that was a good action movie is how I felt when I finished it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to use that for a quote on iTunes. Matt Smith and Matt and Kale Read Comics have never steered me wrong. Tyler Eccles. Kale, any last thoughts or any notes that we didn't get to you want to hit really quick?
Oh yeah. So I enjoyed the comic book overall, and I'm kind of glad that I read it just because I am such a huge Kevin Smith fan, and it was nice to read one of his books about the Green Hornet. I actually want to read his book that he did with Ralph Garman, which is the Green Hornet and Batman 66. After this. Also, I am looking forward to the spinoff podcast that's going to happen when Tyler, he teams up with Jake, called Tyler and Jake Read Graphic Novels. I'm sure that'll be coming up soon. So, that's basically when two best friends get together.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of fun doing this podcast anyway, Kale, but... You know, these episodes are special to me when I get two best friends coming together and we're just talking about comics. I really dig this book. You know, I think Kevin Smith has written some really strong comics. I think, like I said, I got to give props to him that this feels like someone else wrote it. Like he really rose to the occasion and really stepped outside of his usual stuff and delivered on the assignment. The movie that was eventually made, we all kind of touched on it, that it's just kind of okay. It's kind of average. It is strange. It's not strange, but the father-son stuff is handled so much better in this graphic novel. The father-son stuff is kind of hinted at in the Seth Rogen movie. They have Tom Wilkinson show up as Britt Reed Sr. for just like a handful of scenes, like so little that it's like, why did you even bother casting him? It feels like very much like a lot of his stuff was cut out, but like that relationship is never given any time to kind of develop. In the comic, we see much more the dynamic between them, and you feel that loss so much more. And the movie just didn't make enough of a profit, and one of the big issues in my research that I found was that they made it in 3D, which added an extra $10 million to the budget of the Seth Rogen film. And that's why it just never made enough of a profit to justify continuing. But one last note about the film that really just kind of upset me a little bit is it ends with these really terrible comic booky end credits. It feels like something out of like the 2003 Ang Lee, where, you know, he's got like comic booky font and like speech balloons around people's names in the credit and like sound effects and like cut out comic book panels. And it does not feel like something from 2011. It feels like something from the 90s before we kind of realized how serious we could take comic books and comic book films. So that the end credits are real kind of a bummer for me. But anyways, that is Green Hornet by Kevin Smith, Phil Hester, Jonathan Lau. Really enjoyed talking with you guys. If you haven't listened to the last episode, it was a bonus episode. Like I said, I'm doing a creator commentary for my graphic novel, You're Stuck With Me Now. The first chapter is available for free on my website, smithvsSmith.com, smithvsSmith.com. So you can download that first chapter and read along with the commentary. And I am planning to do commentary for the rest of the book. There's 6 more chapters to go and some supplemental material. It was really fun kind of going back and dissecting my own work and really thinking about my own process. And you want to hear from a cartoonist on how they made a particular book? Go ahead and listen to our previous episode on You're Stuck With Me Now, the creator commentary. Kale, we don't know what we're reading next. Maybe we'll release a special little mini bonus episode to kind of let people know. But we'll definitely let you know on our social media what we're reading next. Kale, where can people find us on social media?
You can reach us at Matt and Kale Read Comics on Facebook and Instagram, or Matt and Kale Read on Twitter.
And Tyler Eccles, thank you again so much. It's been really fun catching up with you. Say hi to the wife and all the kids, and hopefully we will talk with you soon, buddy.
Yeah, my love to the fam. Thanks so much for having me on. This is super, super fun.
Great. Thanks so much. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, everyone. Thanks, Kale.
Thank you.